We on? I don't see blue. Now I see blue. Call the House Health Care Committee to order and reopen a public hearing carried over from 126 on House Bill 2009. We have a group of people who were carrying over from the list. We're going to try and make sure we have time in these meetings for making sure we get the folks that have signed up an opportunity to testify. So we're starting today with who? Tom Holt. Who else?
Pam,
are you here?
Martin. Or Linda. I don't know how to say that.
Linda Volch. Here. Representative from the CHP group? No, not here? Okay.
Let me see who else we have.
Dave Fiskum, you want? Dave here from Providence?
He was just outside.
Okay, we'll go get him. But Becker's here.
Becker, we're going to have to put up with you today as well as him.
There he is.
Dave's here now.
Dave. All right.
Did you want
here we go. Yeah. Mike, are you here? Come on. Yeah, you, Mike. We'll start with the three of you. Tom, you're first. Go okay. For it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Holt here today representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to comment on Section 20, and just as an aside, I think it's a wise approach to try and take this thing in pieces and focus on the individual sections of the bill by function. There is certainly an intuitive appeal to putting all the health and health insurance functions under one organizational roof. For instance, it's hard to imagine any downside to closer coordination between public health and other health functions. That said, there are some potential complications that I think augur some caution here. On Monday, I think you heard a really brilliant and detailed outline from Teresa Miller from Consumer and Business Services about the practical difficulties of folding DCBS's insurance functions into the health authority, and would just commend, as I have done, reread those a couple of times. There's a lot of good information and key points made there. And also Bruce Goldberg refreshed us that we've had numerous reorganizations of what's now called DHS, and it's been called other things, over the years, and also had some suggestions of alternative paths that we would commend. Just to add a little bit to that, because hospitals depend on being able to shift a significant amount of the underpayment of Medicaid and Medicare to the private commercial market, that being the insurance plans that do not cover Medicaid, managed Medicaid is also in the same bucket as Medicaid, it's really essential that we preserve the viability of our currently fairly healthy and competitive insurance market as we move forward with health reform efforts. And we're concerned that we could unintentionally set up some problems there if we are not careful. We're also concerned about setting up the healthcare authority in that marketplace as both regulator and potentially competitor to the extent that the healthcare authority may at some point issue its own form of coverage. Another kind of caution is just, and it's I don't think any real surprise to anyone in this room, but just the idea of such a large agency, DHS as it stands now, is already fairly unwieldy from a management perspective, and the health authority may have some of the same issues to deal with. And
would be half the size.
We are also looking at the idea that, you know, as we move forward with healthcare reform, really close cooperation between the public and private sectors is really essential to success. And we're just raising a caution that we may unintentionally, as initially drafted and understanding there's a lot of discussion to go, could sow some seeds of potential institutional conflicts down the road that we wouldn't want to have, where we want to have real cooperation. And just a last sort of example of something I think we need to look at is a function like the Office of Health Policy and Research, which the legislature in its wisdom many years ago set up as a kind of stand-aside agency so that everyone would regard their research and reports and so on and recommendations as being really objective. And over the years, the staff of UPR have, I think, all been regarded as being of very high integrity and their work of being of high integrity. Putting them inside the same agency that to some degree they're expected to be a policy watchdog over may have an effect we wouldn't want to have of, at least in appearance, undermine the objectivity of their work, even though in reality we don't think that would be the case. To the outside world, it might not appear so. So those are just some cautions that we want to raise. They are not items, I want to emphasize, that we would say, oh, you know, unless that's fixed, we're going to be opposed to the bill. That's not where we are. We just, at this early stage of the conversation, want to raise those as sort of caution flags as we move forward in the discussion. I don't have any real concrete alternatives to those cautions to offer you at the moment, but I do want to restate something I think is very important that we've said in every public and private meeting about this general issue, is that the clear direction of the Hospital Association's board is that we do our very best to be constructive in this process, not obstructive, and we're here to be a resource and look forward to engaging in further discussion about this very important issue. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very much. Other questions? I do want to tell you, we listened very carefully to Teresa Miller's discussions, and I think we'll move on that. And I can tell you personally, I've always assumed that the public alternative inside the insurance or in the insurance exchange would not be the regulatory agency, that I've always assumed that the board of the health authority would regulate the exchange and it would be one of the competitors of the exchange. We've talked about that in other places, and I continue to, at least in my context, as we're now looking at the wording, I think we need to make that very clear, that at least that's our objective. I mean, that was my intention. I'm not sure what the health fund board's intention was. Thank you very much. While we're on hospitals and the cooperative public-private partnerships, let's hear from
Chair, I presume that means me.
That means you.
Not you, Michael. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Dave Fiske. I'm here representing Providence Health Services in Oregon. As many of you know, we operate hospitals in Portland, Milwaukee, Newburgh, Hood River, Medford, Seaside, and we also manage an insurance plan, Providence Health Plan, plus a number of special programs for children and senior citizens, in some cases spread throughout substantial portions of this state. I listened to the previous testimony Monday. I was reminded, in fact, of my experience back in the Department of Human Resources, where I was from 1979 to 85. That may surprise some of you. I don't look that old, I know. But as Dr. Goldberg recounted, we debated a lot of organizational changes at that time. We always wanted to do so in a way that followed policy rather than moving boxes around on an organizational chart. One of the key changes we made that I was remembering Monday in those years was to create the then called Senior Services Division, which today is called something different. And the impulse did revolve around policy to create an operation, in fact, that focused on the needs and the concerns of senior citizens instead of lumping that in with what was then called Adult and Family Services. But I digress. Today, I'm not here to debate those issues, but rather to make comments on House Bill 2009 and limiting those in the main to Section 20. I will do so by submitting for the record a letter from Providence Health System signed by our CEO, Russ Danielson, which your staff has or will distribute to you. Allow me to quote just briefly from it as you focus on Section 20 of House Bill 2009 and the third paragraph halfway through. Although, Russ says, although we understand the perceived benefit of centralizing health care operations of government, we, along with my colleague Tom, urge caution in the creation of an authority of this size and scope. There could be value to coordination of information and decision-making, yet this entity could end up being costly and unwieldy. I know that's not your objective. There's also concern we have about fracturing operations that have long been interconnected, such as services to the disabled and the elderly. Our primary concern is the substantial scope of this mega agency and its broad-reaching powers. It's a little difficult for me to limit my remarks only to Section 20, though I will do so at the behest of your chair by simply...
You can have a little leeway if you'd like.
I will not digress too far, Mr. Chair, simply to say that there are other sections preceding 20 which go to the scope and authority of the board, the director, and others, which bear on the existence of an Oregon Health Authority and which I think also bear the kind of scrutiny Mr. Holt has advocated with regard to caution. I also had noted as I reread, Mr. Chair, this bill over the weekend, the language in Section 25 of the bill, which announces legislative findings on the health insurance market in Oregon, and as one of eight major health insurers in this state, along with some other smaller ones, there is, in fact, for all of its failings and warts and problems, there's a fairly vibrant health insurance market in this state with eight competitors who compete every day for business from those who buy health insurance. And so I would question, just as a proposition, the findings section in the first paragraph of Section 25 of the bill, which I won't bore you by reading. Mr. Chair, that's our comment. We urge slowness, clarity in what you do. I appreciated Dr. Goldberg's comment about moving slow to create something like this, the pitfalls contained in it. And with Mr. Holt, we're a member of the association, and we'd be pleased to work with you in refining and honing and clarifying this bill. Thank you for the time and attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fiscom. Here we go. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Mr. Fiscom, I have a question. So your third paragraph, you say, quote, there can be value to coordination of information and decision-making, yet this entity could be costly and unwieldy. In my mind, the benefit of the coordination probably outweighs the risk of where we might go with this agency. And I would, my question is, and you might not have an answer, but if you see value in the coordination, suggestions on how we can get there, perhaps not on the model here, but we need to do something. And it seems like you agree with that. My question is, what do you think we should be doing, if not this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, I didn't come here prepared to give you an explicit answer to that question. As I heard the question, my only comment quickly off the top of my head is to say to you that coordination, collaboration can occur whatever your department lines are. You don't have to move boxes around on the chart, and I'm not demeaning you when I say that, to achieve coordination. That coordination can occur. I'm reminded of the area where I know you have been interested in better coordination, which is an outreach to kids for healthcare, where the existing agencies can do a better job of that. So coordination and care and collaboration between and among agencies doesn't have to result only from changing an organizational structure with all that implies. It can occur because people of goodwill and good faith want to do it.
Follow-up?
Yes.
I guess is my comment to that.
Representative Garrett.
You know, I've spoken with other states on a variety of issues around how we do human services in the state of Oregon. We actually, I think, collaborate better than many other states out there. But I think there gets a point where there has to be combined decision-making in a way that goes beyond collaboration. So I hear what you're saying. I'm not sure if to move us to the next step that that's enough anymore. So, but I appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Senator Garrett.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get too far afield of Section 20, but my question is, the Health Fund Board has indicated that they think their recommendations are really a package deal. Do you think we can accomplish some of their other goals even if we don't do this reorganization? In other words, do you disagree with what I think is their belief that we have to do these things in tandem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett,
I guess I would say that I hope the only answer isn't a, as you put it, sir, a package deal. This is very complicated. The bill itself, Mr. Chair, is obviously very long on its face. The situation is well complicated. I hope it's not a package deal. I hope in the spirit of the way you've organized this, these hearings, as well as other bills in this session, that we can consider these issues each on their own merit. And in particular, at some moment in the future, we'll have to have discussions on the financing of healthcare expansions. And I just hope it is not all a package deal, because I think putting together a package deal of that sort will be extremely difficult, if not impossible.
Okay. I have a question, I guess, of both you and Mr. Holt. I mean, we now have DHS. You take that and divide it in half. Your notion is one of the half. The half we create is big and unwieldy compared to having them twice as big. Is that your testimony here? So I understand it.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would say not necessarily. It's the combination of half the existing DHS along with many other functions not currently part of DHS might get to be kind of a big animal to deal with.
Mr. Chair, my only quick comment, and Mr. Holt has said sort of what I might have said, but I think the other issue for me, and I'm not saying this that we need to leave things just as they are and the status quo is the magic answer, but I think any time you change things of this magnitude, the very act of changing causes lots of consternation, concern, and confusion, and perhaps the end justifies the means, and in many cases organizational changes do, the end does justify the means of that. The means is always complicated, and sometimes it can be costly.
Senator Thompson?
I'll ask both of you gentlemen the same question. I think it's no secret that I have some concerns about this and the speed we're moving. If we were theoretically to delay this legislation, is there room to continue, in your opinion, to continue something like the health fund board for this biennium and work on incremental changes within the existing structure to move towards some of these goals? I'm not so concerned about the big new bureaucracy in size. I'm concerned about the medium-sized bureaucracy in a time of limited resources not being able to deliver the product in a timely manner because of the constraints we have with the economy and funding and whatnot right now. I guess I'm asking you, do you see an alternative to doing this where we might proceed along a more defined route for this biennium, come back next biennium and revisit this? I'm calling on your experience with the health fund board, because I know both of you have been intimately involved with that.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Representative Thompson, I think there are multiple paths by which we might achieve the goals of reform, and certainly what you outlined would be one possibility. I don't know that we need to run right to that direction yet, but you know, I think we ought to be very open-minded as to how we get there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I would only add briefly that you will have before you, I'm going to presume, other bills which would achieve at least the objective you're talking about extending the health fund board. I was among those, and I don't take credit for this as much as to say that I was there when the health fund board through Senate Bill 329 was created, and House Bill 2128, if I'm not mistaken by number, is a piece of legislation which does extend the health fund board at the recommendation of the governor. So that is a policy which at least can occur. That may not be enough, and I don't know that needs to be the answer today, 3 weeks into a session, but I think there are incremental steps to take that so we can be very reasoned and, in fact, cautious, especially given the state's financial condition.
Just to review the road most traveled, you weren't here through all of it, but
that's
in fact,
right.
We spent all of the 2005-2007 interim dealing with this question. The result of that was to spend all of the 2007 session dealing with it, coming to the conclusion that we should create the health fund board. The health fund board spent 12 months, I guess, working on the proposal and gave us what we now have in front of us. So the notion of going back 2 years to start over isn't...
Well, I'm not suggesting starting over, but I see an opportunity for more growth before we launch.
Yeah, and in fact, most of the knottier issues, as we talk about, we are handing back to the equivalent of the health fund board, the health authority board, to deal with in time for the 2011 session. So, I mean, that is built in into this. But the question is, I felt in 2007 we should have started this process rather than creating another body. Ron and I had a lot of those conversations, rather than starting another body to rethink what we had just spent a little over 2 years thinking about. Representative Maurer, you're next.
Thank you. So I will...
We need to get Mr. Becker in.
Okay. Maybe I should let Mr. Becker speak and then I will come back.
Mr. Becker? You have some interest in this whole
microphones. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Regents is the largest health plan in Oregon. We are a tax-paying not-for-profit, somewhat of a contradiction. I don't have the 08 numbers, but in 07 we paid in Oregon, in state and federal taxes, over $26 million in taxes. And I expect that number will have gone up in 08 based on the OMIP assessment. I'm here today representing Regents. We have been actively engaged. Our medical directors and senior executives were appointed by the governor to the health fund board process. We're very desirous of seeing this outcome of health care reform. It is a system much in need of change, and we want to be constructive and supportive of that effort. In order to advance Oregon's vision of a reformed health care system, it's essential that we find an appropriate vehicle to continue the work of the Oregon Health Fund Board. This will ensure the necessary resources for health policy planning, for data collection, analysis, and implementation. It will also create a transparent and focused state role with strong public and private collaboration. I see two competing vehicles that we can use to achieve that result: House Bill 2128 and House Bill 2009. Just briefly in regard to House Bill 2128, this bill proposes making the Health Fund Board permanent and allows the board to continue its work to develop and implement a comprehensive health care reform plan. 2128 directs the Health Fund Board to create advisory committees to assist in further development of comprehensive reform, including health care payment reform, evidence-based practice guidelines, comparative effectiveness and health insurance exchange, primary care revitalization, electronic health records, and medical malpractice reform. Regents supports implementing this structural oversight and the health care reform components existing in House Bill 2128. We find this proposal has the greatest potential to streamline and make more efficient the existing delivery system, drive cost containment, and create a more transparent and focused state role with strong citizen direction. Additionally, given the current economic climate, we find 2128 continues forward momentum of the health care reform effort without significant increase to agency budgets. House Bill 2009, Sections 1 through 25, creates the Oregon Health Authority, a new state agency to oversee all aspects of health care delivery, financing, governmental purchasing, standard and policy setting, regulation, and enforcement. Section 25 of House Bill 2009 sets forth a significant departure in current Oregon health policy and makes a legislative finding that, quote, existing health insurance market forces do not permit the market to operate in a cost-efficient manner or to ensure the availability of health care throughout the state. This section then explicitly states the intent to displace current market forces with a collaborative model under the direction of the health authority and the exchange.
Excuse me, Michael, aren't those words right out of the Health Fund Board report?
I don't.
It's my memory that they came exactly out of the Health Fund Board. These aren't new findings.
Okay. Well, my point still is, when you look at sections 1 through 25, and you look at what is set up through the exchange and the health authority, I think it is less about collaboration and more about expanded regulation. And with that finding, Regents does dispute the assertion that the current health care insurance market forces do not permit the market to operate in a cost-efficient manner. And supporting that, we referenced the 2009 Health Insurance in Oregon report that was presented here just 2 days ago, as well as the 2007 testimony of then-Insurance Administrator Joel Arreo, who testified in legislative hearings that Oregon has the most competitive insurance market, health insurance market, in any state. And just briefly, directing your attention to some of the information reported in this Health Insurance in Oregon report. On page 18, you'll see the market shares of those the major insurers in the state, and you'll see significant market share among those insurers. The report goes on to break down each line of business in the state, individual, small group, large group, and it contains market share components of for each one of those lines of business. And I would encourage you to look at those and see.
We're going to have a full report on this, I think, in the next 2 weeks, so we'll have a chance to go over those things.
So competition is very significant in this state, and no one health insurer dominates in all of these lines of business, so we have significant competition. Regents does have concerns about the expansive authority and unwieldy scope of this new super agency in House Bill 2009. We contend that the authority will not increase efficiency of state agencies, but will increase complexity and implement an expansive new regulatory model. The authority will increase costs for state agencies by duplicating insurance licensing, regulatory, and market conduct functions, and we heard testimony from the insurance department recently in regard to carving out those functions from the rest of DCBS. The health authority will face inherent conflicts of interest as it seeks to do its functions. Among other things, the authority will become responsible for most of the functions of DHS, as well as the health insurance licensing and regulatory functions of the insurance department. As the authority staff and board go about their duties under House Bill 2009, they will see these irreconcilable conflicts of interest as they seek to try to balance those duties under this unprecedented scope of authority. There can't be a level playing field under the health authority when it has the functions and responsibility of policymaker, purchaser of health care, regulator of health care, enforcer of those regulations, marketer to the state, to the citizens of this state, and competitor against commercial health plans. As proposed, the health authority will become a major force in eliminating competition in the commercial health plan market. And with that, I will take questions.
We'll have more discussions about that.
We look forward to engaging in those discussions,
please.
Representative Greenlick.
So, I want to have a little discussion up here at the dais, if I may. Is Chair Greenlee, I was going to introduce an amendment that would delete sections 1 through 27. And that may solve a lot of the conversation about whether or not we're having, whether anything's unwieldy. And I agree, without you saying anything, that you're unlikely to accept that. Now, you would put it out for a vote, and I would appreciate that, but I don't think we would get the votes. So that is not my first intent. Plus, Lori Freeman would not.
That's an easy amendment. That would be just...
Well, no, it's the 400 pages of conforming amendment.
No, she could probably just delete that.
But I think it a lot of these conversations about what the concerns are, Section 25, which I have grave concerns about, the acquisition of healthcare facilities, is for us to go back and look at the bill and let's eliminate those things that we can agree on to eliminate, and that way to tenor the conversation so we don't always fall back to these really sticking points like Section 25. And I think that may temper the...
Let me comment on that. Okay. Here's what I perceive as the process now. We met with LC to talk about the whole amendment process. There have been a lot of things we've heard already that I think the language that came out of the health fund board, which is almost every bit of the language in 209 came directly out of the health fund board, was some interpretation about what it would take to do what it was they were saying. But For example, the language you came with wasn't something we found, something that I'm quite certain came right out of the Health Fund Board report. I've asked folks to organize the amendment process, and rather than going to LC, to give us advance notice of those so we can discuss them here first. But what I've just asked Representative Maurer to do, and we had talked to our legislative council, is I would hope he and I and Tom Burns can spend a couple hours going over the bill right now to take out some things that, to modify things already that we've heard need to be modified. That will have one set of amendments to do that. So we'll create an amendment set that modifies things that we've already heard we think need modifying. Then we'll take a set of amendments from then on, one amendment at a time, and we'll try and keep those relatively parsimonious, but we'll deal with those before the committee on an ongoing basis and vote on all of those that we think need voting on. So we will end up with the -18 or something at that time, amendments we've acted on. And then at the end, create another omnibus set of amendments that will clean up everything else that we need to clean up, including taking out and putting in the conforming clauses that are still relevant to that discussion. So that's the process we think we're going to do now. We'll see how far we can get with that first amendment, which I think might be helpful to some of the things that I think we can make much clearer. We still will leave things in that there'll be problems about, but we'll get out the things that we can get out. But I think it will make this discussion clearer. And I think one of those examples that is the one I mentioned before, and that's that I think we need to make clear that the public insurance program that is perceived under the Health Fund Board report is not the regulatory agency, that it is an independent or semi-independent. We've heard about semi-independent agencies. An independent or semi-independent agency, and make clear we understand where the authority, where the regulatory authority is. I think at least I can tell you I was moved by the DCBS testimony, and I think we need to find a way, which I think we can, that gives the authority board some regulatory powers for looking at rates and maybe for dealing with benefit packages, but leaves a sort of parallel responsibility in DCBS, and particularly with all the regulatory things you do, the solvency and all those other things. I think we're prepared to deal with that. I think we're prepared to listen to what Dr. Goldberg said about making sure there's a time schedule that's not instantaneous, which we can deal with effective dates of different sections. And I think we can, seems to me a logical time would be to have that done by the next legislature, which I think he thinks would be a feasible time. So there are a bunch of things I think Representative Maurer and I have heard from other members of the committee, and we're prepared to see how many of those are to move to work on them. So I hope we'll have something like that before the committee in a couple of weeks, but we will be doing it session. Thank you all very much for your testimony. I'm sorry.
Pass.
Who we got? Representative Harker. Okay. You sure?
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just in light of the comments made by my co-vice chair, I think that, and your subsequent discussion, I think I'll hold my comments until later.
Hey, y'all keep in touch here. All right. Who else are you?
He wants to take his place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And last word.
A question for Mr. Becker and a comment. I think we're going to maybe you and I can talk offline about how we define cost-efficient manner, because just by saying that we have the most competitive insurance market doesn't necessarily make it cost-efficient if we're looking at how do we promote good health and contain costs. So I think there's some discussion there. I guess my question is, the line
17% of the population out of that market.
Well, and that gets to the other. I mean, you talked about the first half of that comment from the Health Fund Board report that says you take issue with what we say about market forces. But the other half of that, the market also does not ensure the availability of health care throughout the state. And I think that's also an important part of that. And no matter how competitive our insurance market is, we obviously aren't. Would you take issue with that second half, that we're not also providing access throughout the state? Is that something the market can solve?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek. Access is not the issue. We have OMIP that provides access to health care benefits for anyone who is able to pay for those benefits. The cost issue is the key issue in regard to why we have a 17% unemployment or uninsurance rate in this state. So to say that the market is responsible for the health insurance market is responsible for the uninsured population, for driving that uninsurance rate, it is not just the health insurance market. It is the 90 cents on every health premium dollar that goes to medical care. That's what is driving, the primary driver of what ultimately leads to uninsurance. So you are absolutely correct that what we need to do is address those underlying drivers that are driving health care costs and, in turn, driving that premium dollar.
Yeah, but Mr. Becker, there are health care theorists who would argue you can use insurance structures to reduce that 90 cents, not just take whatever comes along, add an administrative fee on top of it, and then you have your premium for next year. I think Mr. Fiskum could talk about things Providence has tried to do, and I've had some experience with what Kaiser has tried to do. I mean, I think there are ways to move it. But I also think the other thing Representative Kotek's talking about is the same thing Representative Maurer has talked about on lots of occasions, and that's you have health insurance, but you don't necessarily have access to health care. And that's, I think, almost as important an issue as getting access to insurance as getting access to care.
Chair Greenlake, if I...
Yep, go ahead.
Just wanted to say that we do support the fact that there are administrative efficiencies both on the health insurance side and on the delivery side that will help in that effort, and that health plans are not just a pass-through. Regents actively engages in medical management of our membership and has some significant things that we can talk about and show you.
You get the last word.
No, I will bite my tongue at this moment.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I have distributed to all of you some data that's come from the renowned OHPR. We've heard a lot about what's going on in the hospitals, and this gives you the DRG hospitals and their five-year average across a variety of things, including revenue, operating income, bad debt, a variety of things that are of some interest. The very last page of that has the state's average for all of the DRG hospitals. And the thing I think I mentioned the other day that I thought just so interesting at a glance was the all DRG hospitals as a five-year average had $1.3 billion in operating income and $1.3 billion in the cost of uncompensated care outside of that. Those numbers interest me, even though they're accidentally about the same. It shows the extent to which you can reduce that $1.3 billion in uncompensated care, you can really affect the net operating margins in a fairly significant way. Okay, we have another... No, I need these for you. We have another panel, if I can call... Ms. Johnson? Yeah, we have one more. Two more. That's right, there we are. Betty Johnson... Michael Huntington, is Michael Huntington here? Mm-hmm. And Todd York. Could I have the three of you, please? This is just Okay, who's first? Ms. Johnson, you're first.
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, my name is Betty Johnson. I live in Corvallis, and currently I serve as chair of the Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates, which is a chapter of Healthcare for All Oregon. Our group, Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates, works in collaboration with a number of other organizations with similar functions: the Archimedes Movement, the Physicians for National Health Program, the Interfaith Healthcare Network, the Health Equity Alliance, and then we also work with other similar organizations throughout the state. I like to think of myself as a healthcare advocate beginning in 1972 when I was the director of the Area Agency on Aging, which provided services for seniors in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. In my professional capacity, I never stopped speaking out on behalf of seniors and what their needs were, and found myself often, you know, in a conflict with others who had other points of view. The main point I wanted to make about mentioning, you know, my many years of experience is the fact that it seems to me that over the years, the most serious healthcare problem that I have seen again and again and again is fragmentation. You know, we have all these separate entities, each one certainly committed to their own mission, and yet it seemed like there's no one in charge. No one who was really looking at the big picture and looking at all the components, continuously working on as a team to toward a vision of health for Oregonians. So I speak today in support of the proposed Oregon Health Authority as a means of consolidating all the components of health care to achieve quality, affordable, and sustainable health care for all Oregonians. To me, it's like laying the foundation of a house. Someone spoke of, I think it was in the AARP testimony, that they speak of the roof, and we could look at it either way. We could look at it as a roof or the foundation. This authority can be the cornerstone of the future integrated health system that we all would really like to see happen in Oregon. I was a member of the Benefits Committee on the, serving with the Oregon Health Fund Board, and we frequently talked about integration of services. The board recognizes there is a difference between coordinating functions periodically and integrating functions and services so that all members of the team are committed and involved, working to optimize our limited resources, control costs, improve quality, and most certainly to obtain better value for the enormous amount of public and private funds that we spend on healthcare. Another analogy that comes to my mind, other than the foundation of the house, is that I think about Hewlett-Packard, which is one of the largest employers in Corvallis, where I live. And I ask myself, how successful would HP be if they had an inkjet division, the services division, the personal computer division, and others, each operating without overall direction and collaboration? I don't think they would be in business today if they didn't have the kind of overall direction that they have. So in summary, I just ask you to, each of you, to really give careful thought to the establishment of the Health Authority as it's described in Health Bill 2009. And I firmly believe that establishing this Health Authority starts us on a path so that we can build a strong foundation of our healthcare house. Integrating overall direction and truly building a system of healthcare, not a fragmented bits and pieces all over the place, to obtain more value for our healthcare dollar while ensuring quality, affordable healthcare, which is sustainable. I think this is a very important word here, sustainable for not only individual citizens, but for business, for government, and for our society as a whole. So I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Let's hear from the whole panel, and then we'll have
Yes. Chair Greenlick, committee members. My name is Michael Huntington. I am a co-convener of the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, member of the Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates and Archimedes Movement, and I was a member of the Federal Laws Committee for the Oregon Health Fund Board last year. I speak in support of the House Bill 2009. I was a radiation oncologist for many years in Oregon, and I'll comment later on how I think treatment of a cancer patient was improved by combining authorities. But first, let's talk about why we might not want to create an Oregon Health Authority that has both title and teeth. I can think of two reasons. One is our training from the 60s. Don't trust authority. Question authority. And therefore, question the word itself. This might be a word that is a red flag for many people. Another is that as an individual or business owner, I'm not sure how this authority is going to affect my freedom to conduct business or obtain the health care that I need. Among many Americans, there's a fear that anything that claims to be universal is suspect. And it implies that one size fits all. There's loss of autonomy, and we have to conform to authorities that we have no control over. But I would counter this point of view that our current system or non-system of health care is rapidly taking away our autonomy, both as consumers of health care and providers. And we, the public, must reclaim that authority, give it a clear mission, fund it adequately, and give it a name that means business. I like the proposed duties of the Oregon Health Authority and its board that are outlined in sections 1 through 6 to 15. I'm sure that some of the legislators feel that this is these are too broad and ill-defined. Others think that these do not go far enough. I noticed a comment about 2128 just a moment ago. From my reading of that, that is an advisory capacity kind of a bill that doesn't have teeth. I may be corrected on that. I think that the debates of how much more control or authority this bill should express and what the mission of the authority and board should be should be solved with debates with close attention to the wisdom gained over the past year by the Oregon Health Fund Board and thousands of Oregonians that took part in that. And many of those, the majority of those that spoke out prior to the start of the Oregon Health Fund Board wanted a public health plan, for one thing. And one reason they wanted that is they wanted more oversight about how their health care was conducted and delivered. Now a little bit just about what I experienced in the field of cancer. When I started in the field, patients would go to their primary care doctor and be sent into a surgeon for a diagnosis. The surgeon would send the patient to maybe a pulmonologist or a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, and we're talking fragmentation. We found patients dropping through the cracks. It still occurs, but we made lots of progress through things we call cancer centers, where the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist, the radiologist, the surgeon meet, see the same patient, discuss the same proposals. I think we need to do that with healthcare in general. So after the debates and the voting are distant memory, we need a law that will not only direct us our efforts to improve the health of our people, but will unequivocally give Oregonians the authority to make the tough decisions that will be required. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Todd York, and I'm kind of curious why I was placed on this panel other than...
Because you were the last three witnesses.
Okay. Works for me. Anyway, I'm an insurance agent here in Oregon, and my office is here in Salem. I've been doing that for over 25 years, including about 5.5 years working as a service representative and marketing rep for Blue Cross Blue Shield. So I have some idea of what goes on the carrier side as well. I've been selling health insurance so long that when I started 25 years ago, it was actually affordable. So that gives you an idea. I'm a member of a couple professional organizations, the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, as well as the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and that's really why I'm here today, to talk about what the NAFA's position is as far as what's going on in 2007. And since that's turned into such a monster, I'll just restrict myself to those a couple items there. I do like sharing the panel with these.
You mean Bill 2009?
2009, yeah. Sorry. It's comfortable for me to be here with two advocates because I'm also on a member of a board of a health clinic here in town that serves the underserved. We have more Oregon Health Plan patients than any other clinic here in Salem. And I also support the work of the Oregon Health Fund Board. You know, I really believe in their goals of having a healthy population, providing extraordinary patient care, and keeping the cost reasonable. Now, those are lofty goals, and I'll be amazed if we can tackle them all at once, like was being discussed with the last panel. As far as what an agent does, hopefully they've distributed a piece that came actually out of the Oregon Health Fund Board's own report. It talks about the goals of the health insurance exchange. If you read down those points, it sounds to me, when I read it, like a job description for a good health agent. I think most of my clients would consider me probably their most valuable ally and their biggest advocate for keeping their health care costs down and for trying to make this health insurance world understandable. I'm kind of a foot soldier in that battle. I'm sorry I was a little late today. I was coming back from Corvallis. I met with a small business owner this morning, about 10 employees. He is dealing with a 31% rate increase on a group health plan. And because of some work I did for him and because of, you know, the market is what it is, we have eight strong carriers in the small group market. And I can't do this with all my groups, otherwise I'd be the most popular agent out there, but he's going from a 31% rate increase by moving him to a little-known insurance company called Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is not his current carrier. He'll go to paying a little bit less than what he was paying last year. So that's the kind of work I do. Getting to the position paper that you should all have a copy of, there's a couple issues that's a part of the legislation that we have a concern about. One is the creation of this insurance exchange as the sole provider of individual insurance. In other words, if you wanted to buy individual insurance under the Oregon Health Fund Board's proposal, you would have to go through the insurance exchange. And the process they've outlined is a request for a proposal would go out to the carriers. Carriers would submit their proposals. And it sounds to me like they will choose two or three carriers to participate. Everybody would go through the exchange and those two or three carriers to get their coverage.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Are you getting this out of the bill or out of the Health Fund Board report?
Health Fund Board report.
Not the bill that's in front of us.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I would assume it's you're following those guidelines. Is that inconsistent with what your bill proposes?
Basically, the bill gives the Health Fund Authority Board responsibility of producing a plan for the exchange
Okay. That
will come to the next legislature.
Okay. Well, that's what they're proposing now. I have read that report. So that's what they're proposing. If they do that and they choose, right now we've got 8 carriers in that marketplace. You have 3 and they're the exclusive providers of that insurance. The other 5 are going to go away. So if 2 years later those 3 carriers raise rates or it's not working, you've eliminated over half the marketplace. So that's a concern. And if you've addressed that in the bill, then you can forget everything I've just said. Don't have to worry about it. But that's what's outlined by the Oregon Health Fund Board, and that was their proposal in their paper. The other thing has to do with eliminating the role of the insurance agent. Part of the reason I gave you the preface about what I've been doing today is because that's what I do every day. Well, 5 days a week. But I'm advocating for my clients, making sure, you know, like I said, if you read through the goals of the insurance exchange, it doesn't read like any public entity I've ever seen. And it does sound like my job description. In other words, make it easy for people to buy, compare the various plans, minimize the disruption that comes from, well, like this group I worked with this morning, I'm going to have to move them from one carrier to the other, carry on meetings, educate them about how to access the benefits. Now, I know this is a huge bill, and I apologize for not having the opportunity to read it before I came here. I came on short notice, so I'll just confine my comments to that and take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the panel?
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And this is an issue about the exchange. Currently, under Medicare Part D, when it was implemented, you weren't out there hawking Medicare Part D plans.
I do that now.
You do that now, but when it came out, essentially seniors were kind of go forth and figure it out on your own. It was a very complex process, and there was an organization that's around the state in many communities through Retire Senior Volunteer Program. I had opportunities for seniors to go in, and they assisted them. But that was done purely on a volunteer basis, and I would hate to see our system of, because we're still going to purchase insurance, at least my view of it, we're going to continue purchasing insurance, whether through business or on your own, and you know, I don't necessarily want to rely on the volunteer program to achieve that. And do you think that within this exchange model, that there could be ways for you to still exist? Because the only reason you exist, hopefully, is to provide value for your customers in making a purchase decision. Otherwise, your consumer would go directly to the insurance company.
Agreed.
And so do you think there is a way to work with this exchange model to come up with, you know, kind of balancing both sides of that equation?
Absolutely. First of all, you could make the exchange voluntary. If people were struggling finding coverage, just make it voluntary. I mean, I really support, like I said, I support the goals of the Health Fund Board, and few people know as well as I do how broken, I even hesitate to use the word system in connection to the way healthcare is delivered. But, you know, if it provides an option and works better than what's going on, or works better in Burns than it does here, the question of access came up, and I mean, one of the big problems with access, as much as cost, is, you know, if you're around providers very long, they'll talk about the shortage. I mean, we don't have enough healthcare professionals to go around as it is. And part of it is, you know, again, I know we've got Archimedes movement supporters here. One of the comments I really like by Kitzhaber is, we cannot control rising healthcare costs unless we fundamentally shift our goal from financing healthcare to improving health. And so I, getting back to your question, I think by making the exchange voluntary, if it worked, if it's a better widget, you know, so be it. But I think it could be handled that way in areas where there aren't agents. But I think that's one of the problems of the exchange, is if it's a bureaucratic type function, where are you going to have an office in Bend and Pendleton, Portland, Salem, Eugene? So you got five locations. Whereas the agent community, we got people in every community.
We need to move on. The last word?
Well, can I follow up on that?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you for that. It sounds like what I hear you saying is that you sort of like the concept of the exchange if it's dealt, if it's used as access and information, as a tool for any of us to access information to find the best insurance plan. I guess my question to you would be, and on a voluntary basis, like you said, my question to you, because I've had a lot of professionals in your business come to me and just with the fear of God over this issue about the exchange and what it potentially does to their livelihood. Do you see the role for the insurance agent as something, if the exchange is voluntary outside of the exchange, or can you envision a role for you, once again, if it's completely voluntary, a means of access information within the exchange itself?
I think either way. I think we could be incorporated into the exchange, because you're still going to need, like I said, the goals of the exchange read like the kind of work we do now. It would be a good fit.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have, did you provide this Appendix C of your
testimony? Yes. That came right out of the Oregon Health Fund Board draft.
It comes out of the exchange work group of the Finance Committee and its recommendation. I don't think that got it into the final report in this form.
Through a few versions, and it was fun to follow all that.
Well, thank you all very much. Oh, yes, the final word from
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, may I make one comment to clarify something that was said?
Absolutely.
I haven't memorized the Oregon Health Fund Board report, but I have read it again and again, so that I am trying to understand it. And I would like to clarify that it was my understanding that the way the insurance exchange would operate is that the exchange would set standards, just as the insurance division does now. There are certain requirements that you have to meet in order to sell insurance in the state of Oregon. And so the insurance exchange would set those standards and then would request proposals. And I don't think, at least I didn't hear any assumption that the result would be that there would only be two or three insurance companies in the whole state of Oregon that would be interested in complying with those standards. So I
think we have a lot of work to do on where the exchange will come. But I do appreciate you all being here. I think it's important for us to hear from individual citizens as well as from our institutions that are involved in this. They have a legitimate concern about what's going on, but so do our citizens, and we're going to have a lot more citizen testimony before we're done.
Thank you
all very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before you move on to the agenda, I just want to acknowledge that Rick Bennett, the director of the AARP, submitted some written testimony relating to HB 2009, and we'd like to recognize that for the record.
Great.
Okay.
Supporting it, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what he told me.
Yeah.
Thoughtful commentary.
Exactly.
Commentary. All else is commentary. Let's close the hearing on HB 2009 and open the first public hearing on HB 2058. And I'll ask Mr. Powers to guide us through this. Bill, this is the third of a series of four, or the fourth of a series of five bills on on health licensing board cleanup. Go for it. We don't have it in front of us, do we?
You told me not to pass out the bills.
Well, okay. Here's what I did suggest. And
okay.
Excuse me just a moment, Mr. Powers. We have two options as a committee. We can pass out the bills each time, or you all can bring your computers with you or your bill files with you, and we can save that. And we'll do whichever makes sense to you, but it will be more responsibility on the committee members. In past, we pass out any bills that we're discussing. There's some interest in doing less of that. So, do you have some immediate comments on how you vote?
I like bringing my own bill folder, and that way I have all my notes.
Okay.
And including the bill. So that would be my practice.
Okay. Yeah. Generally speaking, that works for everybody? Okay. I need to remember to do that now.
Although we always appreciate how well Sandy takes care of us in many different ways.
She sure does.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate your willingness to change.
It was my proposal, and then I showed up without either a computer or a bill.
And he says, where's the bill?
Where's the bill?
You told me not to bring the bill.
Tom, would you please move on with this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Powers, Legislative Director, Office of Representative Mitch Greenlink, House District 33. Some of you, hopefully most of you, have in front of you House Bill 2058 relating to regulation of health professions. And this is the third, I believe, or perhaps the fourth that you've considered in a series of proposals that would amend statute relating to the health professional regulatory boards, of which there are about 17 or 18. This particular proposal goes through mostly the appointment service, terms of service, and dismissal or vacancy parts of the board statutes. And it comes from, again, the initial review conducted after the 2007 legislative session concluded, which found a large discrepancy from agency to agency or from board to board due to the fact that most of these boards were created not at once, but over time in response of the development and the continued progression of the different professions. And again, in this building, the different boards are subject to an immense amount of legislation brought by both the professional organizations that have an interest as well as consumer groups. There were 64, at least, bills relating to the health professional boards in the 2007 legislative session alone. And as a result, these boards have developed a lot of inconsistent statutes relating to some of the processes that they all share. And in that way, they may be more oriented to the membership of and the licensure or the licensees of the particular boards than they are to the access to the services that these boards provide to the general public and the consumer. And the most fundamental discrepancy is probably the subject of House Bill 2058, which is, again, the appointment, terms of service, and dismissal of the board members. Representative Greenlink and the committee felt during the review of these boards during the interim that it's important to bring these boards' accountability standards in line with one another so that the public can reasonably expect to know what the process is from board to board when trying to access services that these boards provide, which is accountability over and information over the professionals that they regulate. The current labyrinthine organization of these health boards requires the consumer to have more of a bureaucratic mindset rather than a consumer mindset, and it's harder to resolve a complaint, and it can be equally as hard to find out exactly how that complaint will be processed. Well, the first step in standardizing the procedures could be to take a look at the member appointment, service, and removal provisions in statute that will allow these boards to respond more strongly to the needs of the public and to be accountable to, I guess, a larger organization that falls more accurately within one of the three branches of government. And this bill puts that responsibility and accountability and oversight pretty much squarely within the executive branch with the advice and consent of the Senate for the initial approval of the members. One of the most strong positions or provisions of this bill is that the governor will be able to take immediate action to dismiss any member of a board to hold that board or the entire board accountable for its actions or lack thereof. And such an incident occurred at the very end of the last legislative session when the Oregon State Board of Nursing took no action to remedy the lack of leadership provided by its then executive director. So by putting it under the direct supervision of the governor, although they still need the advice and consent of the Senate, they will be directly accountable to the governor based on their performance and how the governor wishes them to perform. Getting into the actual text of the bill, you'll notice that it is almost entirely conforming amendments to existing statute, going board by board, starting with the Board of Psychologist Examiners. And then it basically applies consistent statute, as you'll see in the bold. If you take a look at the bold, you'll see it repeated in each section and iteration of the boards. And I guess I'll just go through not each board, but rather what each of the new provisions does. Currently, there's a whole barrage of lengths of terms for the board members that vary between 3 and 4. Almost all boards have 3, with the exception of about 5 of them. So about a third of the boards have 4-year terms for their members. Most have 3. House Bill 2058 would increase the length of the term in all cases to 4 years. All of these board members would now serve at the express pleasure of the governor, meaning they could be dismissed for any reason and at will, rather than having to be dismissed for cause, for direct cause. And the boards that currently require a reason or performance, such as not being able to properly execute duties, include the Board of Nursing, the Chiropractic Examiners, Physical Therapy Board, and the Board of Respiratory Therapists, which is within the Oregon Health Licensing Agency.
Excuse me, Tom? Where does it say, or how do I interpret, that the governor can relieve at will?
They all serve at the pleasure of the governor.
And where, I'm just looking at section 1.
It should be in each one. The intention here, if we haven't done it that way, is originally about a third of the boards said they served at the pleasure of the governor.
Yeah.
About a third of the board said they could only be dismissed for cause, and about a third of the boards were silent on it. So this simply...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think Representative Garrett got the right section. And the Board of Psychologist Examiners, which is the first one here, it's already currently in statute, so there's no bold.
Okay.
But if you keep on going, you'll see it in bold in almost all the other cases. And in the ones where it's for cause, you'll see italics and brackets. Okay, some of the other changes in the bill, Mr. Chair and members. So once all members serve at the pleasure of the governor, we also put in a provision that the public members of these boards cannot be family members of a licensed professional of the profession in which they regulate. So if my brother were a pharmacist, I could not, and he was currently licensed by the Board of Pharmacy, I could not serve on the Board of Pharmacy under this bill. The bill also puts in conforming language to stipulate that...
Excuse me, Tom.
Just as long as we're clarifying along the way, definition of family member, I got a call into the Ethics Commission today related to our gifts provision around family members, and it's a broader... we defined, I guess, in that bill, a broader set of family members than we could have.
Representative Greenlink, Representative Cannon, I think family member is probably designed to be quite broad in here, but I don't think that was an intent of the committee. It may be defined somewhere else in statute. I'm not sure in any of these chapters it's defined. But I guess the stake would be it only applies to the specific profession or multiple professions within the board. So it's highly likely that you wouldn't have too many health professionals in your family, although that is the case in many families.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just follow up. The family member provision is related to public members on the board, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I am a psychologist, then no one in my family is eligible to serve on the board under this bill.
It's a public member.
as a public member. I think that's how I read the bill. And
that's the intention.
I guess I would like clarification on what sort of definition of family member we're intending to use or are actually using in this bill.
We can note that if they're not in there, we can reference one of the definitions.
Yeah.
And that was Garrett's question.
Is that your question as well?
Yeah.
The Essex Commission is sibling and their spouse, child and their spouse, parent and their spouse, right?
It's and our siblings, if I remember correctly.
I believe that there's probably a less restrictive definition. LC would have to give us some choices.
How about immediate family? Was that?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's an important point. We'll make sure.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, we know what it is.
We'll get written.
Yeah. It needs to be defined.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is repeated throughout the bill. So if that was a prerogative of the committee to clarify that, it would happen across each of these boards where there's conforming amendments.
It's in existence already in some of the boards, right?
Mr. Chair, there are a few different definitions of who, it's not necessarily related to family in each of the boards. Each of the boards has a different stipulation for its public members with relation to that public member's interests in the profession, whether that's a pecuniary interest or a familial interest. But that is not a consistent trend from board to board if you look at the statutes. And House Bill 2058 would standardize that, but it's important that we make that clear in the bill, if that's a prerogative of the committee. The other things that, if we can move on, the House Bill 2058 takes from board to board is that board members will be removed if they are not Oregon residents, which seems pretty clear. If you don't live in Oregon, you don't have the capacity to serve in the state of Oregon. If you have three consecutive unexcused absences, or you're not currently licensed by the board and you are there in a capacity as a licensed member of that board. I think I also missed in my notes here that all members will be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and I think that goes without saying for most of the practices now, but it explicitly says that for each board in House Bill 2058. Terms are also staggered to limit coinciding vacancies, so you can't have, in most cases, more than two terms expire simultaneously. That also helps the governor's staff interview and find appropriate replacements for the board members, especially public members, which I understand are harder to come by. It also allows continuous reappointment, so we're repealing term limits, in a sense, for each of the boards. Most of these boards, you can only serve 2 3-year or 2 4-year terms. So this is another allowance for allowing members to keep on serving, which will hopefully alleviate some stress in the governor's office in searching for public members.
One of the notions of having 2 4-year terms and allowing a third term is that that would be a different governor than appointed the first one, so it would be at least a different governor over that time if it was determined that it was appropriate for a member to stay on.
Are we going to kind of discuss these issues as we go through them now? Is this a quasi-work session, or how are we doing this?
I think he's almost done.
There's just
a few
more things,
we'll get some testimony, and then I think we'll have some discussion.
Because I'm having some questions about...
Yeah, we don't have a possible work session, but we'll act like we do.
We'll just have a friendly discussion, perhaps, Mr. Chair.
All right, we won't. You ask him questions, and we'll get a response to anything you want to discuss.
Yeah.
While he's sitting there.
All out of jail.
Well, I guess I'm pretty willing to wait till afterwards if we're going to have a little discussion afterwards. I have some concerns about term limits and having this extended too much and
staggering. About having term limits or not having
them? Well, I think it's a good thing to have term limits myself.
Okay. So. Are there any other
questions?
And
I also think they ought to be active they ought to be active licensed folk, which is, I assume, your next point, or close.
Actually, I have a question, Mr. Chair. Just for the background to this, Tom.
So is the primary reason to eliminate term limits to deal with the problem of finding public members for the board? Is that what
Mr. Chair,
moved us in that direction?
Representative Denbrough, that is, I think, an unintended positive benefit of requiring this policy, and I should have described it more as, since all of these members will now serve at the pleasure of the governor, and these terms will be 4 years, it is likely sometimes that the governor will change, the governor, governor's office will change hands, and the new governor may feel so inclined to appoint new members at the expiry of a term. So by providing greater power in members serving on the pleasure of the governor, that minimizes the effect or the need for term limits and the intention of this bill.
We heard a lot of testimony in the interim that it takes a long time to really get a board member up to speed on what they were going to do, and that if they expected it would be very rare for any member to want to serve more than 8 years, that this is a hard task, but that we didn't want to eliminate possible people with knowledge and interest if they and the governor and the exec sec thought they ought to stay on. So what we were trying to do is to remove the possibility that if there was somebody who wanted to stay on and everybody, including the governor, wanted them to stay on, that we would make that as a matter of choice rather than a matter of fixed term limits. And that's where that came from.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who do we have first?
Well, it was Representative Denbrough.
Denbrough, are you?
That was my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, Thompson.
No need to be sorry. Thanks.
I'm not too sorry.
You said I'm sorry. In a lot of these board relations, we have things set in statute and then things set in rule. Is this intended to be open and closed so that there isn't any modification of this by rule? And I'm thinking specifically about making membership distinctions within some of these boards, because we're changing healthcare practice pretty rapidly with practice extenders and whatnot. I know there's some discussion going on at the Board of Pharmacy about putting pharmacy technicians or representing them on the board.
Same question. About
now, I read this about the Board of Pharmacy made up of pharmacists, kind of pharmacists only. Would that require then a statute change sometime in the future to come back and say we want to have a representation of...
Yeah, that's not any different than now.
Okay.
This isn't changing that.
Okay, yeah.
The composition one we talked about last week would change some of that. But yeah, right now I know there is, a legislative proposal.
Oh, is there one?
To add a pharmacy tech to the pharmacy board. Yeah. It would require a statutory change.
Yeah, okay.
But that's not changed by this at
okay.
all.
I just perceive a lot of changes coming up in how some of these professions are put together and question about how we...
We're going to have at least four or five more bills about around these boards before we're done. We have a governor's bill coming up soon that cleans up some issues. Mm-hmm. We have, I expect, several other...
Okay.
Opportunities we'll have to deal with. But this doesn't change any of the basic things. All this changes the appointment process, the removal process, and term limits. And there's some cleanups in there that the LCs did on language and things, but basically there's no other changes in there, I think.
Mr. Chair, I think that from my perspective, the most important aspect of this is not term limits. It's about the ability of the governor to, that the member serves at the pleasure of the governor, because that was an issue. And we clearly found that that was not consistent across the language, across the boards. And in my view, it needed to be, and I think it was your view, and I don't think there's really much disagreement in that. But I think you could throw some of this out, and that was a big deal. That one piece was a big deal.
Yep.
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Maurer, I think that is exactly the intention of the bill, as I remember one of the initial committee discussions, to establish more of a chain of command in regards to who the board members are responsible or who they report to in terms of being dismissed or, you know, fearing consequences for action or lack thereof. And Representative Thompson, in regard to professional organizations having more of a stake in the appointment process, this bill also tries to standardize board-to-board the ability for respective professional associations to develop a list from about 3 to 5 names and have the governor consider appointing from that list. I think that statute...
For the professional members.
For the professional members, not for the public members, that is correct. And then just a couple of the last things that this bill does promotes geographical and ethnic diversity by saying, excuse me, that the governor shall consider geographic diversities within Oregon and also ethnic group. It does not change the proportion of membership that is within House Bill 2056. It doesn't change the impairment program reporting requirements for board members and its licensees. And lastly, it doesn't really change the executive director relationship with the board, rather than the fact that the board members would explicitly serve at the pleasure of the governor. And then there are some other changes in there with regard.
The execs always serve at the pleasure of the board.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct.
Something in the governor's bill on that,
maybe. Yeah.
Basically, now the execs serve at the pleasure of the board.
But that's not in this bill.
It doesn't. This bill does not address that. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any other questions?
Oh, Representative Harker.
Representative Harker.
Thank
yes,
you,
sir.
Mr. Chair.
You don't gasp the way my other vice chair does, so I know you get this gulp of air and I don't know
which place and position is for.
There you go.
Have some sort of reaction.
There has been standardization, as you just mentioned, across geographic area and ethnic group put in here. And I noticed that in the standardization, in some of the sections, there was removal of gender and age. Comments? I wasn't there for that.
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Harker, I think the instruction in putting this down in LC was take out elements that were inconsistent from board to board and apply elements that would then be consistent under House Bill 2058. And I don't remember or perhaps was not present when the decision was made to only include geographic areas and ethnic group as classes of distinction for selecting members. And I think in also considering, I think there was a policy choice that the committee may have wanted to make into fighting family. You might be able to pursue similar amendments to expand or make that more narrow.
I think it's enough. May I follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. I think it's going to be enough of, I don't think, I'm not lobbying on behalf of including gender and age. I think it's going to be enough of a challenge for the governor and the other people to select in a board of these sizes sufficient people to represent the geographic diversity and the ethnic group. I was simply curious as to the thinking behind that decision.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. I know that in the other bill we're talking about proportionality of members, but in the effort to be consistent, was there a discussion of the number of members on the boards, I mean the total number? Was there any discussion of making that standard, whatever the number might be, 7, 9, whatever? We're making other things standard. Is there merit in making the total number standard?
There was never a recommendation to do that because the nature of the board, the size of the board, I mean, the size of the profession, the scope of the profession, various laws. So we didn't have anybody propose having everybody a 7-member board or something. But we're gonna get back to discussion on,
right.
We'll have room for that in the bill on public membership, and we can talk about that. I've been getting a lot of comment on that that we might want to do what some boards suggest is increase the public membership without decreasing the professional membership. And what kept us from doing that was I was anxious not to put a fiscal on that bill. But there are some feelings that might be a de minimis fiscal, but that would by nature change the size of the boards if we do something like that. So it's something we'll have before us when we start working that bill next. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Oh, a question for Mr. Powers. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was reading the written testimony we have from the medical board, and they have a concern about, apparently back in 97, they changed from four-year terms to three-year terms. Their argument is that helped reduce burnout. People were more willing to re-up for a second, third-year term versus a second, four-year term. I'm wondering if it would be possible to check in with a couple of the boards who have four-year terms, if the four-year terms has indeed been an issue in terms of retention and burnout. And it just was an interesting point that they made, that they had went, they requested to go from four to three for some retention issues and just kind of, you know, keeping people there. So just something maybe we could look at.
And we also, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also have testimony from the Board of Nursing addressing their concerns about the term limit language in the bill also that I was going to pass out a little bit later, but this seemed like a prime opportunity to mention it to you folks.
We'll ask Ms. Mercer to come and talk to us about this in a moment.
Oh, she, okay.
I'm going to ask, before we're done, I'm going to ask the administrator to seek from LC an amendment that would define family in some form or another. I think what it would also make sense to do, Sandy, would be to seek an amendment to change the four-year term to three-year term so we can have that amendment in front of us and we can discuss it in a way that makes some sense.
Okay.
It just sounds like if we're looking for consistency, maybe the issue is three versus going
four. Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it'll give us an ability to debate it ourselves and vote on which we
prefer. The rationale for why four was picked was explained, and now we're getting some pushback.
Some other rationale.
And this, which makes their rationale sensible. So.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kotek, Vice Chair Maurer, I also talked with Nancy Gostarian, who's the executive appointments staff for Governor Kulongoski, and she indicated to me that the three-year term option for some of these boards, which is the majority of them, was also to, at the governor's request or previous governor's request, to circulate the members and get fresh input, new thought processes and things like that, so that the discussions around regulating these professions and become stale.
I did not hear from the governor's staff that they're proposing three versus four, but we'll put that in front of us and ask the governor's staff to talk to us about it. Tom, thank you very much for your hard work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
For a long time. Let me call to testify Patrick Bratz, who I see back there.
And Mr. Chair,
Holly, you want to join us? Does that see here? Yes, she's here.
She's here. She wanted to avoid it.
Yeah,
I know she's trying to avoid it, but she's a good public servant. She'll be here.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while we're waiting and giving these folks a chance to settle, the Department of Human Services has requested a technical amendment on this bill, and you will notice that as you look at sections 19, and I'm just pulling that out, it says there is established the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Then when you go to Section 21, it says, there hereby is created the Board of Naturopathic Examiners in the Department of Human Services. We want to take out, where applicable, that in Department of Human Services. All the boards referenced in this bill are freestanding or semi-independent, no longer need that reference. So just as a housekeeping measure, the agency would like us to draft an amendment.
There are about four or five.
Yes.
It also says in there that the director is responsible for oversight, which of course the director didn't know he was responsible for. I'd like to ask him periodically, how's the Board of Dental Examiners doing? How's the Dental Board doing, Bruce?
So with the committee's permission, I'll draft that amendment.
Yes, please. So that'll be three. I guess they can all be three separate amendments.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm here today on behalf of the board to testify the Board of Dentistry, Patrick Bratz, Executive Director, in support of 2058, HB 2058. The board is supportive of the fact that in looking at this, you were calling for some uniformity in the qualifications of board members, both public and professional, that provides for the selection of the board members by the governor and lists specific reasons for their removal, and then also gives the governor the power to serve the pleasure. The Board of Dentistry had that power right now. They serve at the pleasure of the governor. Like the idea of the oversight, our board members are confirmed by the Senate right now, so that's not a change for us, as well as giving the board authority regarding the compensation for board members, placing it back into the board, saying by administrative rule within their budget, if they wanted to set the compensation different than what is in the statute that currently for our board makes it $30 a year. So, and to answer the question, which may be in your minds, we're happy with the four-year term. I think the reason we're probably happy with it has been announced earlier is that it does take some time for people to get up to speed. The Board of Dentistry meets approximately six times a year. So, you know, basically in that first year is pretty much a learning curve. And so you got 2 years and then you could be gone or you could be reappointed for another three. We've never had a problem where, at least in the tenure that I've been around or that my staff has told me, where people have not wanted to stay on for the additional 4 years unless there were some extenuating circumstances, family or whatever. And I think you're right, as you said earlier, Chair Green, like the 8 years is kind of like, okay, I'm done. I'm out of here. We had just recently, we had a board member stay a little longer than eight. The governor asked him to stay because we had a problem with getting the vacancy filled. And he said, sure, I'll stay a couple more months if that's what you want me to do. So anyway, we're supportive of the bill.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director for the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing is regulates all nurses, advanced nurses, and certified nurse assistants. We regulate 70,000 licensees, 50,000 nurses, and approximately 20,000 certified nurse assistants. We have a staff of 45. We also have a ratio of staff to licensees of one staff to 1,500 licensees. We review 2,100 complaints a year. 1,400 of those complaints relate to law enforcement data systems complaints, basically a criminal history check, and about 600 complaints we call conduct complaints. We are neutral on this bill. Our comments to the committee relate more to some feedback we had from our board members that they felt that 2-3-year terms was a very large commitment. And when we mentioned the possibility of 4-year terms, there was a great sigh that took place over the board members. Our board packets, we meet 5 times a year in 2-day sessions, 6 times a year with a 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. conference call. So 11 times a year. We are absolutely tasked with the enormity of the complaints and responsibility on our board. And at a later date and on another bill, I would be happy to discuss with this committee the challenges we've had, particularly over the last year, coming out of the 2007 changes that we had, the discoveries we've had in the nurse monitoring program, the discoveries we've had in referral to law enforcement. We feel like we've come a long way, and I will go into great detail about the lessons learned. This bill, we feel, primarily confirmed what our board members believed would happen, would be that there would be, they would answer at the pleasure of the governor. Our board members are ready to accept that, and that's why we've taken a neutral position on this bill. I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
I'm going to comment first. I think you've done an extraordinary job bringing order to that board into your process, and you're very much admired for the work you've done. You're still there, right? You haven't quit.
No, I'm absolutely committed, Mr. Chair. I would also like to say, however, that I think lost in the fray of all that turmoil was the fact that we had a very committed staff that took us through those times, and I, every chance I get, I do want to compliment our staff and the effort that they made. It was very traumatic. I've sat through several committee hearings, not only this committee, but other committee hearings, and the Board of Nursing is often mentioned as the poster child of turmoil and, you know, kind of boards that had some challenges. And I think that we have a story to tell about how we have improved the Board of Nursing. And I think other boards could gain some knowledge of that because of our size and the volume that we look at on a, you know, monthly basis. We have to stay diligent. There is not, you know, a month that goes by that our board isn't concerned about misses in communication, not having that proper collaboration with other agencies. So, but I will be back before this committee.
That's
there are
great.
Bills before you that we want to weigh in on.
I'm sure I would only amend your statement to say those employees that are still there are the ones.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to echo the thank you and all the hard work of the staff. And we look forward to hearing your budget next week in the subcommittee.
Yes.
So your opportunity to talk about all the good work you're doing. So,
thank you.
And I want to ask you this question, not necessarily related to the bills, but it's a comment I made in a previous committee. You do represent 20,000 CNAs.
Yes.
I just want to put it out there. I would hope the board would consider adding a CNA in the near future to your board. I think in terms of having that representation would only be fair.
I think that's our job, right?
Well, but I'd be curious. Yes, we could certainly do that, but I don't know where you are in that discussion, if that's been discussed.
Representative Kotek, Chair Greenlick, it has been discussed as we our current board makeup has two licensed practical nurses. There is no official requirement that they come from long-term care. I think that I believe that we do need to have a voice of long-term care on our board, and whether that is through the nursing level or through a CNA level, we have many, many concerns about long-term care and what is happening with delegation, unlicensed personnel, and those are truly troubling cases. So I do believe our board is open to it.
Okay, thank you.
You don't have a governor's proposal on that, do you?
No, we don't. Do not.
Thank you both. Thank you for everything.
Thank you. We'll
close the hearing on House Bill 2058. We'll get some amendments. There's not been much opposition to this. It's just a lot of details, and we'll get those amendments. And Tom, I want to thank you very much for the hard work you've done on this. I would like to open up a work session. Is that right?
Yes.
I'd like to open a work session, the intention of which is to accept some LCs to be submitted to the Legislative Council for committee bills. I'd like to remind the members that have not been a part of this that you don't need to be in favor of them. I'm not sure I'm in favor of any of these three. It's just to get them into the process. They'll go in as committee bills. They may be assigned here. They may be assigned somewhere else. But this is just a step to get the process moving. We have LC 1627, which deals with something called a cost-sharing ministry. We heard some testimony about that model, and it would recommend that it be handled in insurance regulation in a specific way. There's one bill intended to reduce crowd out when we expand coverage for kids to talk about who's eligible relative to whether their employers provide health insurance options for them. And there's one requiring the Board of Pharmacy to deal with an electronic monitoring program on, Jim, is it class 2, 3, and 4 drugs?
I believe it is as it stands right now.
Okay. It's one that we had before us last time that didn't make it out of here. There's been a lot of discussion on the Payne Commission, and will be some proposals for handling this both in the Senate and here. This is a parallel bill, I think, to what's in the Senate now as well. So if I could, I'll entertain a motion.
Do you want a motion on all three, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
One at a time?
Okay. Yeah. Let's do a motion on all three.
Mr. Chair, I move that LCs 1627, LC 1712, and LC 2488 be introduced as committee bills.
Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I will concur with moving these forward because I know the intent is to, you know, as a committee bill. I have some concerns with LC 1712, but I just want to point that out so maybe we can discuss that further. Whoever you... he's interested in this bill could talk to me about it.
I have concerns with all three of them. So. Yeah, I'll be glad to point you.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Representative
Kennemer? Aye. Representative Kovac?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Mauer? Aye.
Representative Paulson? Aye. Aye. Motion's adopted. Any other business we have?
Well, I guess I was under the impression we were going to have a little more discussion regarding 2058.
When they come in as bills that they're assigned to us, we'll have lots of discussion about all three of them.
No, sorry. Not a work session, I understood.
Perhaps to raise questions?
Do you have any comments of my own, I guess?
Please, go for it.
Years ago I did serve on one of these boards, and then at Clackamas County we had 59 boards and commissions that the commissioners appointed. And I've had a little bit of experience with some of these kinds of things. I guess for me, first of all, we're going to define family member, and I don't know that's a big deal, but I'm not sure what difference it makes either, by the way, but that's an interesting one. We ought to at least define it. I guess I would be inclined to encourage us to consider having term limits of two terms. And the reason being that I think if we're not careful, one of the things happened is people get a little co-opted over time. And it's good to bring new people in and new faces and new ideas. And consistent with that, I also think it's inappropriate to have inactive licensed people as professionals on the board. For example, I am a licensed psychologist. I'm a semi-retired psychologist, but I'm not an active license is what it's called. The truth is, I'm not completely up to speed on a number of issues. I would not be an appropriate professional member on that panel. I think that's true of most non-active people on board. So I think they ought to be active licensed would be my... these are just merely my thoughts and suggestions. And I also think that, we have huge variations. I mean, 70,000 licensees, criminy sakes, versus, I don't know, I think the Board of Psychologists, the one I'm familiar with, we have a little under 1,500. And we're still a fairly large board. There are much smaller boards. I just find it hard to come up with one size. That's why I think there ought to be some flexibility on the term limits, because I think burnout is an issue. I remember my workload and the amount of time it costs. So I think we ought to have some flexibility about whether they're 3 or 4 year terms, depending on the workload for these folk. So that's my nickel of
thought. Thank you. You know, I'm a pharmacist in recovery, and that's the last thing they want is me on any board.
Likely a dangerous entity for all of us, frankly.
Yes, sir.
No, just it's a conversation there was, not a rebuttal, but
yeah.
If you are on a board and your license lapsed because you retired, they wouldn't immediately terminate you. I think that was really the intent, that they would not immediately terminate you because you no longer have an active license, but you could finish out your term.
Have an objection to that, frankly, because you're obviously up to speed when you retire and you're active and you're probably staying on top of it. But,
right.
I hate to think when the last time I did my full continuing ed requirements.
Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, this was a thrust of my question about the practice extenders, too. I have some questions about uniform numbers on these boards as we move forward, because in some cases we want to add practice extenders to boards. We want to add more lay citizens to boards. And I fear a time that we're going to end up with one professional on a board, and then the rest of it is lay citizens and practice extenders for various parts of the support structure. And I kind of think we ought to move cautiously on this. I would rather have a larger board with more input than to swamp out, you know, traditional professional input.
I can assure you, we move glacially. Is there? We're adjourned. Note for the record, it's 10 minutes to 5.
You can't bank it, Mr. Chair.